All right, we're live. I am so excited today to have a good friend of mine on the Manifestor Mindset. And name is Jay Shetty. He's got the most beautiful eyes you've ever seen and great hair. But more importantly than that, as if those gifts weren't enough, Jay Shetty also has the answers to the test, which is what I want to talk about today. But we met a couple of years ago, I guess, and spent a really incredible night together just talking philosophically about life and whatnot. And I discovered, the whole world already knew, but I had discovered for myself just how insightful you are and how wonderful you are. So Jay is out with a new book, which is amazing, called Think Like a Monk. And it's already New York Times bestseller. So this interview is kind of like old by now, because the whole world, I thought I was going to get you so early, but you move so quickly. And today I just want to share his wisdom about a topic that I'm really passionate about. I've spent a lot of time in my life. My number one favorite book is called Buddhism Plain and Simple, which is just whenever I'm down or I'm in a dark place, I always return to that book. It's the one thing I go back. And to me, it's truth. So I've read The Power of Now. I've been sort of obsessed throughout my life. I've aspired to implement a lot of these principles that you talk about in your book. And I'm always falling short. And you and I will text about it like, Jay, bring me back. So we have a real treat for the audience today. It's to really talk about these principles that Jay talks about in his book that will bring you back to the now and hopefully help you find peace, but also professional success. And so I'm going to kick it off. For those of you who don't know, Jay, can you share a little bit of your background?
Yeah, absolutely. Matt, it's such an honor to be with you and so grateful for this opportunity. I love the incredible work you do over here on LinkedIn, and it's phenomenal to see the amazing insights that you have that are sharing and helping so many people in their professional careers. And yeah, actually, you got me perfectly. New York Times, we don't find out about till Wednesday next week. So right now, we're number one on Amazon in a ton of countries. So actually, we've
let's just be honest, right? Isn't that the only thing that really matters? I mean, you're only on that little thing called Amazon. That's all, right?
Well, very grateful to you. And yeah, if you don't know who I am, my name is Jay Shetty. And for the last 4 years, I've been focusing on making wisdom go viral. I believe that wisdom has existed for thousands of years, and I'm just trying to make it more relevant, accessible, and practical for all of us to live by today. And my new book is called Think Like a Monk. So you don't have to live like a monk, but I believe that there are mindsets and principles in a monk's mind that can actually access your deepest potential and your true levels of happiness and success. So this applies whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a stay-at-home dad or mom, whether you're someone who's working inside a large organization. This applies to anyone and everyone if you want peace and purpose in your life.
You make a really incredible point in your book, and come in with the questions. I got Heather on my team. She'll be throwing it to you in a little bit, and after we spend a little time with Jay. But you make a really good point in your book. Nobody is born a monk per se, right? So you know the journey to become a monk is usually through different roads. Like everybody out here, they have jobs, have careers, have professions, like you did, right? So can you tell a little bit about your journey of discovery?
Yeah, one of the biggest things about thinking like a monk, which I think is apparent for everyone, is that becoming a monk is actually one of the most rebellious acts in society, because it's completely going against what society is telling you to do. And so I'm sure that in your life, whether you've got a product idea or a business idea, all of you are in some way having to rebel with your background or where you started out. So you're having to break the mold. You're having to do something different. And so the monk mindset, that's really at the root of it, is trying to do something that may be counterintuitive or different to what everyone around you is doing. And that's really the premise that the book is based on, is how can you find your clear and unique path despite all the distractions and opinions and expectations and obligations that are all around you.
And when you were young, when you went through your journey and starting in London and journey of discovery, was it an epiphany or a single moment? I know you heard an incredible speaker, right, that sort of woke you up, but was it a process to embrace these principles?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. And I'd say for me, I was born and raised in London, and I was trying to do what I thought I had to do, which was get a good degree, go to a good school, get a good job, get married, then play golf, I guess. I don't know what's next, but I was following that path. And for me, it was very much at the age of 18, meeting a monk. And that was very unique for me because it was the first time I'd really met a monk. And for you, it may not be a monk, but think about it in your life. Who is it that you've met, or who is it that you've not yet met, that could change the trajectory of your life? And for me, I went there that day not expecting very much, because I was interested in hearing from people who I thought had achieved something. And then I realized when I spoke to him that he'd actually completed and received something so powerful, which was joy. And I thought about it at 18 that, and this was the epiphany I've had in hindsight, that when I was 18, I'd met people who were rich, I'd met people who were famous, I'd met people who were beautiful and attractive, I'd met people who were smart, but I don't think I'd ever met anyone who was truly joyful and happy. And that was really the epiphany, that this person had something. And by the way, he also went to a top university in India. He went to the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT, which is one of the most reputed universities there.
But it's like MIT, to put it in context, right?
Yeah, it's equivalent of MIT. So he traded that to serve the world, and that's what inspired me.
And so you go on this journey, you immerse yourself, you become, I guess, a monk, right? Monk is an interesting misnomer, right? It's got a religious connotation, but it's also about embracing these very spiritual but not necessarily religious principles, right? So how long did that journey last before you decide to change direction, but embrace us and share the wisdom?
Yeah, so I decided that I would spend all my summer and Christmas vacations during my time at university. I would start spending them in India just training and shadowing. So I'd spend half of them interning at a finance company in London, and I'd spend the other half interning with the monks. And so it's almost like I was doing these two internships, very different. One was bars, steakhouses, and suits, and the other was robes, sleeping on the floor in cold showers. And then when I graduated at 21, going on 22, I decided that I wanted to live as a monk. So I turned down my corporate job offers, and I moved to India and lived as a monk. And I was there for 3 years, and I really wanted to do it. I really wanted to do it for the rest of my life and for as long as I could. That's what I imagined. But through my time there, I found that I had very different personality traits, and that I wasn't meant to be a monk, but that these monk mindsets and these monk principles, which were universal, timeless, and accessible to everyone, could really transform the lives of people that I grew up with, could really transform the lives of people in the modern world that I lived in. And so for me, it was all about extracting all of those messages and insights so that I could share them when I came back. And my teacher said to me that they felt I could share them if I left and I could share what I'd learned.
What I love about what you're doing, this collective body of knowledge that's been around for thousands of years, right? Which, you know, I had stumbled upon, which instantly brought me not only peace, but felt like my first exposure or taste of objective truth, you know, this category of what in my life has been, you know, Buddhism. But you take these general principles and you are now exporting them or making them accessible, because I do think that some of them have somewhat of a branding problem. So I want to get into this. You think that in order to embrace these ideas, we have to cross this threshold of religion. Can you first just start out, is it religion? Is it not religion? What is it? Because usually think of religion, you think of a deity, right? You start with a deity and you go from there. Can you help sort of explain to everybody how to embrace it, or how to cross that threshold?
That's such an important question, Matt. I'm so glad you asked it. So what I believe is that in all of these wisdom traditions, there's the religious aspects, the more spiritual aspects as well. And then there's the life principles that are just synergized across all of them. And these life principles have been there for thousands and thousands of years. So if you look at the rise of meditation and mindfulness, monks and traditions have been doing that for thousands of years. If you look at the rise of yoga in the modern world today, that's been there for thousands of years. If you look at lots of management strategies and business approaches, a lot of them exist in the Vedas. So this ancient wisdom is actually completely, and this is what true wisdom is. True wisdom is universal, timeless, and accessible to all. That doesn't need to be religious. It doesn't need to be believing in a particular god or deity. It doesn't need to be believing in anything. It means practicing it in our lives and experiencing the benefits in our lives. And I think that's what wisdom is. It's practical, and you can actually experience the benefits without a belief, but the practice of the tools and techniques.
So let's provide a definition of what we're talking about. We're talking so abstract. You have a great line. I think you quote Einstein in your book about the ability to reduce something to its simplest possible explanation, right? So how do you explain the overall body of your work that's covered in Think Like a Monk? What is the theory?
Yeah, so the theory in Think Like a Monk is that if you can go to the root of the issue, if you can uncover all of the layers of identity that you think you have, but actually go to the root of the identity that is truly you, which means the best version, the most authentic version of yourself, then you're more likely to be happy and successful. And finally, just discovering yourself is not enough. If you don't use it in the service of others, if you don't use it in a way that can make a difference in the life of others, you'll never feel complete. So the three sections of Think Like a Monk are let go, so letting go of our past and our past beliefs and habits, grow, finding our purpose and discovering our unique potential, and finally give, how we can actually give that all away to the earth.
And what do you think when you, so starting, I love the way you organize the book and the sort of journey of transcendence, right? What usually stands in the way of people letting go? You know, how do you get unstuck?
The biggest thing that stands in the way of letting go is that it actually, we feel safe even in our pain, right? We feel a sense of security even in our difficulty. So there's something that Thich Nhat Hanh, an incredible Buddhist monk, one of my favorite authors, he talks about the difference between familiar and unfamiliar pain. And Thich Nhat Hanh says that we would rather choose familiar pain than unfamiliar pain. We'd rather keep having the same pain again and again that we know of, rather than get into the unknown of, oh no, if I quit my job, then I don't want to deal with that pain. I'd rather deal with the pain that my boss hates me right now. Hmm. And so it's really that sense of false safety and false security that stops us from letting go, because we're more scared of the unknown than we are of what's familiar.
Well, interesting in a business context, right? From a cognitive bias, one of them, I love reading different cognitive bias, figuring all that going on with me, what's wrong with me and how to hack it. But one of them is called loss aversion, right? That we would rather avoid a loss than pursue a gain. So yeah, these general principles of wisdom, they permeate throughout your life, right? Who you are anywhere is who you are, you know, everywhere.
Yeah, so you're I love that. Just to add to your point you're making is sunk cost bias. I think a lot of us believe that we've worked so hard on a particular degree, we've worked so hard on a particular career in a particular industry, we've made somewhat of a name for ourselves, and you've got all that sunk cost, and now you can't go, oh, well, I've got to start from scratch again. Like, I've got to start from the beginning again. And that's why we main. I love biases in.
That's one of my favorite. I send you something. What I love about LinkedIn. Hello, LinkedIn. You know who you are out there. I believe you're from Albania. But I one time got a message from somebody who decided to take every sunk cost bias and turn it into this incredible decision matrix about like 200 of them and broke them down. I sat there for an hour, like most extraordinary thing. But what you just hit on in sunk cost fallacy, right, is one of the ones that makes people stay with what they're doing all along. One of the proudest things I have on my wall right now is my beautiful law degree. It cost me whatever it cost me. And as soon as I graduated, I never became a lawyer a day in my life. And I felt so good because it's not like it lost its intrinsic value. I still am theoretically a lawyer. I learned everything I learned, but I knew that it wasn't right for me. And I think you have to sort of refine that and have peace. And usually what I find people hold back is the fear of judgment too, that you're going to be, you know, judgment, or the fear that you look flighty, and all these other issues are sort of nonsense. But to stay with your journey. So once you've mastered let go, which you work people through, then the next phase is what?
The next phase is actually growing and discovering your own passion and purpose and your own potential. Because you're not going to be able to fully let go until you know what the next path is. It's almost like you're like swinging from branch to branch. And it's like you've got to be able to hold on to the next one before you let go of the next last one, otherwise you end up feeling like you're going to fall. And so it's almost like a symbiotic relationship. And one of the big ones that came up, again, going back to biases, because Matt, like you've just, I love biases. And
when I text you at 5 in the morning, because you're one of the earliest wake, by the way, you're one of the few people that I could text really early that is, you know, that is up. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that when you look at the next stage of grow in the book, one of our biggest blocks to growth is confirmation bias or groupthink bias. So we surround ourselves with people that look like us, sound like us, went to the same colleges, grew up in the same areas, have the same thoughts and views in society. And that is groupthink bias or confirmation bias, where you look for people around you to confirm what you think. And in terms of growth and transformation in business, it doesn't work. There's an incredible story that I want to share with you, which is of 2009 when Mark Zuckerberg, and he tells this story himself, he was struggling with the direction of Facebook. And so at this time, he went to speak to his mentor, and he was struggling with the business of Facebook. Remember, he was only 5 years old then in 2009, and 2004 is just when it started. And his mentor happened to be Steve Jobs. And so he goes up to Steve Jobs and he says, Steve, I'm really struggling with the direction of Facebook. What should I do? Now, if you think about it, in 2009, Steve, I mean, there probably wasn't someone more connected in the world than Steve Jobs. He could have picked up the phone to any investor, any hedge fund manager, any business coach or advisor. And Steve Jobs gave him this advice. Steve Jobs said to him, I want you to go and spend time in this ashram in India, this monastery in India. And he goes, when you do that, you'll then find the direction for Facebook. And Mark said, that's exactly what he did. And he went and lived in the ashram. And that's where he found out that Facebook was going to be about connecting people. Now, that is a perfect example of how to break confirmation bias and how to break groupthink bias. So I always think about this. When I come up with a new idea or a new insight, I'm excited to see what humanity thinks and technology thinks. If I could get feedback from the Dalai Lama and Jeff Bezos, that's going to get me a really interesting paradox. And really, it's the paradox, as Steve Jobs said, that creativity is just connecting things. It's the paradox where interesting things happen. Interesting things don't happen when you just do the normal thing that everyone else is doing. So to me, polarities and embracing and connecting polarities is really where business and life success happens.
And how much of that Mark Zuckerberg story of being able to take a break, go to India, is also about the transformative power of being present, of sort of waking up and being present now? Can you talk a little bit about how meditation fits in to your overall philosophy?
Yeah.
Really in the business context too.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about meditation, the most common thing I hear, and I remember when I used to work in the corporate world and coach in the corporate world, the number one thing I'd hear is, I don't have time. I don't have time to meditate. So I believe people want to meditate. They can see that there are benefits. There are so many scientific benefits from boosting your immunity, better brain health.
Smaller amygdala, right?
You know, exactly.
All sorts of issues.
Yeah, so people are connected to the benefits, but people say they don't have time. So here's how you have to think about it. Imagine you turn up to a meeting, but you're frantic. Your mind is on. There's so much noise. You read the news in the morning. Your kids are, you know, crying. There's so much going on. And you walk in with stress. Guess what happens? It's contagious. People feel the stress from you. They experience it in your presence on a call, on a Zoom call, on the phone. But imagine you took out 10 minutes a day. Let's say you took out 20 minutes a day. You centered yourself, you calmed yourself, and now you walked into that same room. How much clarity do you think you're going to have to make the right decision? And how much clarity is contagious for everyone else in the room? So that 10 to 20 minutes is actually going to end up saving you time, money, energy, relationships. And that's where it really has its benefit in how it ties into the overall philosophy, is that meditation isn't a burden or something you have to do. It's something that sharpens everything else you do in your life, from communicating to a conversation to a conflict with someone. Meditation is going to refine that for you and give you clarity.
I find amazing that if I meditate, and I'm one of the ones who aspires so much to do it, it's probably my greatest shortcoming in life, that I deny myself the greatest gift, which is to be present, right? I think to be present is the greatest gift you could possibly, and it's also the only thing that's guaranteed, right? Totally. So the only pure truth you could truly connect with is the moment. But when I find I meditate and I come out of it and the colors are so vivid, and I remember thinking, is that my imagination? Is that my bias? And I remember I went real deep. You can too, those of you watching. There's a great article in Psychology Today about 6 years ago that talks about the study, right? That just doing meditation for however many days, 20 days straight, 30 days, 20 minutes, will actually change the brain chemistry and structure of your brain and shrink the part of your brain that controls fight or flight, the amygdala. So, you know, if you need science to prove it because you don't want to believe it spiritually, there's another way to get there, which is factually, it will make you happier and more at ease and you will make better decisions. But there's also a great study that you talk about in your book, right, Jay, where a series of monks went through different studies and tested their brains. Talk a little bit about how it had transformed their brain and their life.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you said there, Matt's spot on that, you know, and that's why in the book I share so many scientific studies, because I also am someone who loves science. And I think that's what this book attempts to do, is I'm trying to find that synergy between science, spirituality, and strategy. And I think that's where businesses, that's where I think entrepreneurs will actually be at their best. And you see that in successful entrepreneurs. You hear Mark Benioff talk about meditating. You hear, you talk to Bill Gates, they talk about meditating. You talk to athletes who are meditating, whether it's LeBron James or Kobe Bryant, when I interviewed him, meditated. You know, so there are so many incredible people in the world that turn to meditation because of its scientific benefits. So going back to the book, some of the studies that I look at in the book are studies done on monks' brains. And Matthew Ricard, who I had the pleasure of interviewing, a Buddhist monk, he's said to be the world's happiest man, and he has the happiest brain in the world. And they scanned not just his, but they ended up scanning 20 to 30 other monks' brains, and they found the highest form of gamma waves, which are linked to calm, happiness, attention, which is presence, what Matt's talking about, and joy. So what monks actually have the calmest, happiest, most joyful brains on the planet. And that's why Think Like a Monk is such a practical guide to get there. Because just imagine how much your business would change, how much your relationships would change in your business when you have that attention and presence that Matt's speaking about.
All right, Jay, I'm going to represent maybe the naysayer voice, right? So that way we can, first, here's the book. I don't normally plug books. This book I thought was such a gift that I ordered a massive box of them that's sitting on my desk. I'm going to give them out to people because I think it's so important to discover the power of now, being present, thinking like a monk, what you're doing and translating these to a business context. But I'm not going to represent my evangelical passion for you. I'm going to do the opposite. I'm sitting out there right now. I said, this is all well and good. You're a nice guy. You seem sweet. You have great blue eyes. I am a business person. I'm running my company. I got predators and people coming left and right, naysayers, haters, COVID. You know, so I have no time to be this kind and generous. So talk to that person who rejects and says that this philosophy and your monk principles won't apply in a business context, especially in a time of a crisis.
Yeah, I love that. So the first thing I would do, and I love doing research and being really clear about stuff. So I've just literally Googled, just to help this discussion, I've just Googled CEOs that meditate because I think it's really important for people to learn from the people that actually that they aspire to be like. So whether you're inspired by Jeff Weiner, right? Big entrepreneur, I'd say that people would be inspired by Jeff. Jeff meditates, and I'm reading this from a Peak Wellness article, and I literally just Googled it now. And it says, Weiner is a former Yahoo executive, but you probably know him better as the CEO of LinkedIn. He blocks out time every day to practice meditation. Weiner notes that gives him time to think and to practice empathy and compassion, which has a positive impact on his productivity. If you look at someone that I think, like Steve Jobs, if you actually analyze his life, there are countless examples of his interactions with meditation. So first thing I would do is ask someone out there saying, who do you admire in the world of business? Who is it that you're trying to be inspired by and follow in the footsteps of? Do a tiny bit of research into their life. And I guarantee you, you will find somewhere in their life where reflection, introspection, meditation, or mindfulness are pillars of their day. I interviewed Ray Dalio last year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Ray Dalio talked about his connection with transcendental meditation and how it's such a big part of his life. And that's Ray Dalio. I mean, it's worth $20 billion. So if he thinks it's a good idea to meditate, then that sounds pretty good to me too. So I would go down that route and say, just look at someone you're inspired by, study their life, and I'm sure you're going to find something in there that's connected here. And if that doesn't inspire you, guess what? You're absolutely fine to have your opinion. And whenever you get to a point in life where you feel that there's a need, people will find their way. And that's, I really trust that, you know, my approach is never to force or to preach that this is the only way. My approach is that I think we all go through certain experiences in life, which will bring us to a more conscious way of living, whatever that may be.
No, and a few points on it. And what's fascinating, what you just said, your Google search, I was about to say the exact same thing. What you'll find with meditation is any CEO who does or leader who regularly meditates will always invoke meditation as the prime reason for their success, ironically, right? So back to the big picture, what your book is doing and what the principles generally do are all designed to bring you back to now and the moment, right? Meditation brings you back to now. And in terms of other principles of integrity and telling the truth, I always say there's a reason why a lie detector picks up a lie. It creates a physiological response. Your body is out of kilter, right? Mm-hmm. So telling the truth, being present, connecting with the moment, they all make you also more effective, right? Because you are unburdened. And one of the things I love about meditation too, I could be self-centered, frustrated, angry, seeing the entire world through my own prism. It's mostly distorted because, you know, your brain is flashing. You meditate. Afterwards, I wake up and all my energy is external. I feel the empathy just surges and it feels much better to be in a place where I can give it away rather than take it back. So for those who don't believe, I think we've done enough. I want to share as much as I want to keep you. I want to share you the world. So Heather, why don't we open it up for, I know you're so crazy. So I'm going to open up for a few questions and then, and I'll release you back to the earth. But Heather, why don't we put a couple up there?
This is fantastic, Matt. While we're waiting for the question, this is fantastic. I love how you think about this and are able to help it contextualize for people. I really thank you for that. It's a gift.
Well, I remember when we sat down together. Remember when we talked about it? I was unburdening with you all the things I struggle with and grapple with. And I just love putting it out there and thinking you did something that I feel like no one's done. You took the book that I have, The Power of Now, which is about taking Buddhism, right, and making that accessible. You translated these incredible principles in a non-religious context, and you're now making them broadly applicable. And I think I will say this until the day I die. The closest I come to truth is when I connect with these principles. And the happiest I am is when I'm disciplined about it. Unfortunately, we all stray. We move away. It's the one thing you and I text the most about, right? Jay, bring me back. You know, I'm usually looking for a cheat, you know, like a simple formula, but or give me a deity of sorts or somebody to follow, you know, a leader. But it brings me happiness. So the idea that you're putting it out the world is amazing. Let's answer this. What truly drives you intrinsically, the number one factor?
Yeah. So from the number one day I started, my intention or desire has very clearly been to use my gifts and talents in the service of others. And that's my intrinsic driver for everything. It's like, I believe that I've been given certain strengths, certain skills, gifts and talents, and I believe everyone has, and I'm just trying to use those. So I feel the greatest pain in the world that I see is people not living to their potential. And what I mean by that is I may not be the smartest person in the world. I don't think I have the brains to solve a disease, or I don't think I have the brains to make a difference in a particular area. But if I can help people find their potential, then someone else is going to create those incredible solutions for the world. And so that's what I'm trying to do in my own way. And that's why I started. And that's what I'm still doing. And in the book, I have a chapter called Intention, which talks about the four key intentions from a Vedic perspective. And those four key intentions are either fear, desire and result, duty and responsibility, or love and compassion. So anything in the world, anything you've ever done has been motivated either by fear and insecurity, desire or result, duty or responsibility, or love and compassion. And the point is that the more we do out of fear and insecurity, the less joyful we are. And the more we do out of love and compassion, the more joyful we are. And that can be any activity. I'll give an example because you talk about intrinsic motivators. If I'm working with someone and I have two people who want to give money in charity, let's take that as an example. You could give the same amount of money in charity, but person A gives it because they want a good PR story out of it. And person B gives it because they deeply believe in the cause. That's two different motives. One is desire and result, and one is love and compassion. Who do you think is happy? It's obvious. So you can do the same activity. You can start a business because you want to be famous and successful, or you can start a business because you want to help people. You're more likely to be sustainably successful if you did it to solve a problem. And Peter Diamandis puts this the best. He says that, you know, we should redefine the word billionaire to be someone who helps a billion people. And that how that creates it. So yeah, hopefully that answers your question, Wesley Tebble. I hope that answers your question.
Great question.
Yeah, really great question.
Well, the number one, I like this sort of, we're being very precise. The number one most efficient way to find your purpose, Jay.
Yeah, so in this book, Think Like a Monk, in chapter 5, I take the principle of Dharma. Dharma is an ancient Sanskrit word, and it can be translated in English to eternal purpose or your natural inclination. And the way it describes it, and I'm summarizing it for you in the book, I have a 33-question guide that helps you get closer to your purpose and your dharma. But if you take it as an equation, purpose equals passion plus strength plus compassion. So the number one most efficient way to find your purpose is passion plus strength plus compassion. What do you love and enjoy? What are you genuinely good at? And by the way, let me just talk about that good at. Don't confuse inexperience with weakness. Just because you haven't practiced something, just because you've never experienced something, doesn't mean that you're bad at it. You can develop strengths that you don't have. And third and finally, compassion. How is it being used to help other people? So even if we take Amazon, for example, because it's such a popular example, the reason why Amazon is so successful is that it's really good at what it does. It has high strengths, right? It gets delivered next day or the day after. The reason why is compassion. You may say, well, where's the compassion? Well, it's serving a need that we all are saying that we want. And obviously they're passionate about customer service. So they are fulfilling that. And that's why it can be seen as a purposeful thing for them.
I love that. What a great, that's a great message, Jay. And I love the way you can distill it all. And, you know, for those out there who think, well, Jay is not me, right? Jay is a former monk, and he's living this kind of, I could never live up to him. When we spent our time together, right, I remembered you are on it. You're on task. You're as efficient. You know, you're as focused. The difference is, though, when we were spending time together, right, we were on this pretty important mission. We'd put a lot of energy into it, and everything fell apart for that moment. And I was ready to, like, rip somebody's head off. I was red, my Irish red face. And I remember, and I partly didn't want to deal with you either because I thought you'd be having a similar reaction, and I got to manage you. And then I see you, and you're like, it's okay, Matt. Whatever's meant to be. And you're right. I wanted to strangle you, actually, because I'm like, what? Stop with that. Why are you so superior? but my point is to everyone out there who feels an otherness today and thinks, you know, well, you can't be this great. The reality is he's also focused and on it. He's navigating the world like you are, running business, doing what he's doing, but just from a slightly different perspective that enables you to handle those little ups and downs in a very different way.
Yeah, and I make mistakes too. And I think in the book, that's what I talk about. Like, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I'm not always fully mindful. I'm not always fully present. I'm moving fast sometimes and I need to learn to slow down. So I'm sharing a lot of this because I'm still practicing and figuring out myself. But I know that it works because in the areas of my life where I have effectively and diligently put it into place, it works. And Matt can say that in his own life when he's practiced it. When we met, I didn't know about his fascination with any of this. I was actually pleasantly shocked and surprised when he told me about it. I was like, wow, like someone as successful as you feels this way. I was like, this is amazing. And you know, that's why I love you so much, Matt, because you're just and you're a paradox in and of yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're on Shark Tank. You're this incredible teacher at Harvard now. And then on top of that, you're like inspired by Buddhism. I'm just like, this is incredible. Like, why can't we all allow ourselves to be more of ourselves and be more like just allow yourself to break the labels, break the boundaries. And I say this all the time, like I try and think like a monk, but I love working in media and I love being able to do what I do every day. And so it's about becoming truer versions of ourselves, not trying to lock ourselves up in a box.
Well, that's a really important point. What you just said right there is that one of the hardest ways, you know, to your point, you can't really define what I do. I do this, I do that. But it's the reality is, why am I going to conform my behavior to some external expectation so that my narrative is tight? And then I'm denying my true expression, which is why I love talking about these topics to you. There's a lot of people out there who might want to not want to make that move for fear of judgment because it's inconsistent with whatever construct they have created for themselves or that it's being imposed upon them by a loved one, by their parents. Like, forget about that, right? Like, the one thing, there's a great book called The Five Regrets of the Dying.
Oh, yeah, really good.
And right there on the top of the list is the regret that you lived your life to conform to other people's expectations and you never were true to yourself. So if you're to do nothing else, to let the naysayers win, who are only coming from a place too of their own fear and anxiety, like to let them impose upon you their vision is really surrendering who you were meant to be, right? So I'm glad you called that out because I feel really proud of the fact that it's completely incoherent my entire career and I don't really care. Let's take one more. So if you got a creative purpose, how do you weigh your intentions for the project between love, empathy, and drive and ambition? What's the best way to approach your launch?
Yeah, so I think the best way to do it is that you'll be attached to the result if you're not focused on the preparation. So a lot of us get lost in our expectation instead of focusing on our preparation. And what I mean by that is if you're trying to, like, for example, I just wrote a book and the book's out. And so I've spent the last 2 years writing the book, researching for the book, getting the best team behind the book, preparing for the book. So all my energy has gone into the preparation. And so when it came to launch day, I was just like, I'm really happy to see what it does now because we've already done our best. And now you've got to be able to let go and move forward. So the way you weigh your intentions is the first thing you do is anytime I have a new opportunity, I write down every opportunity that's there in my life. And then on top of it, I write down why the intention that I'd want to do it. And so sometimes I'm like, okay, I'm only doing that for the money, doing that because I want ego. I'm doing that because I want love. I'm doing that because I want desire. Like, I'm being really honest with myself. And then I relook at it and I go, okay, well, how can I do that? Not just for that reason, but how can I try and upgrade it to do it out of love and compassion? What can I do differently with this relationship or this person or this business or this product that actually allows me to upgrade my intention? So that's how you weigh your intentions, by being honest with yourself and then going, okay, well, now let's upgrade it.
I'm smiling because I remember that night we had the conversation in California. This was the topic. It's amazing we're ending on this topic. It's kind of mystical. This was a topic we talked about at the end when I said to you, how do you separate the fact, if you're very smart or you're focused on pattern recognition, you sort of know the consequences or the natural consequences of your actions. How do you separate being aware that this is what will happen when you do X, Y, Z, while keeping your intentions pure? That you're not only doing it because that will happen. How do you live in a place where, like, I'm aware that people might respond to this if I say this or if I post that, but it's not why I'm doing it. And I'm doing it because, and it's okay to have both. You're okay to be aware of the consequence of your intentions, right? You're a sentient being, right? But keeping your intentions pure is also so, so important. That's how we ended our night, by the way.
I know, that's amazing. Yeah. And I'm so glad you've made that point, Matt, because that night we were talking about how none of us are 100% pure and none of us are 100% impure. We're all percentages and proportions in between. And the goal is we're constantly trying to move towards being more purely intentioned. So don't be like, oh my God, I'm not 100% getting this all right. I've still got to be doing this for a bit of money or whatever it is that you're doing. The point is to move in the right direction and not, you know, push yourself to be like, oh my gosh, I haven't achieved this yet.
And that's how I look at my decisions too. Is this next decision going to be moving closer or further away from the person I want to be? And then if you have children, by the way, I always say this to myself too. When my child looks up at me, what do they see?
Yes, that's beautiful.
And can I be closer to what I want them to see? I'm going to let you go because you are the busiest man in the world. You did today's show today. What'd you do today in the morning, Jay?
So it was yesterday, the whole day. We did Good Morning Britain in London. Then we did the Today Show in the New York, and then we did the morning show in Canada. But this was, to be honest, Matt, this was so fun because I love how you live truthfully for your audience and how you helped guide this to contextualize it for your business and entrepreneurs audience. And I love this conversation because I really believe the book does have insights for entrepreneurs and business people, but you've really brought that out of me in the book today. So thank you for being
To everyone out there who's watching, who's wondering if you could live up to it. The number one conversation I have with Jay is confessing my sins that I haven't been able to fully embrace it because I know it's just outside my reach, but I don't give up because here we are talking. This book is fantastic. I'm going to encourage you to buy it because I think it can help your life. Look at this great comment. This is brilliant. Loving it. Loving you, Jay, on so many levels. And hope you come back in a few months. We could talk about how it's going and your next where there's going to be.
And you've got to come on the podcast when you're next in LA or I'm in New York. We want you on. So thank you, man.
Everybody, have a great day, Jay.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for watching. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.